The race is on, and Mercedes had another trouble-free run to a 1-2 in the British Grand Prix. Well, it did, until things started to go wrong in the final three laps, when first Valtteri Bottas and then Lewis Hamilton suffered punches. It was a dramatic end to a race that was otherwise pretty straightforward at the front, but gives us plenty to talk about. I'm Ed Straw, and joining me as always are Mark Hughes and Scott Mitchell. Now, Mark, a rare occurrence this year because we're actually in the same place for this podcast, for once having retreated to a nearby hotel. So we can have some proper arguing.
Yeah, well, I can argue remotely or in person. I'm easy.
Go for a bit of fisticuffs, maybe?
Well, I'd have the advantage of being able to run away, but yeah, if you like.
Well, we've set the agenda for some violence, but normally we don't disagree too violently. Scott Mitchell, of course, you are once again in your Stockholm front room, dialing in, ensuring every driver in Formula One is very, very familiar with the wall and what you've got in the background. So you're pretty comfortable being on screen there.
Yeah, I'm used to it. I now have quite regular comments. Actually, people have started to pay attention. The drivers haven't started to survey what's on my bookcase and stuff like that. But I have had some tweets and messages and emails from people spotting some stuff. Eagle-eyed viewers or drivers and team bosses this week would have noticed that my sim racing setup was removed from the background. I got told off. I got told off by my girlfriend. Well, I should say told off by my fiance now, for leaving it out when I promised that I wouldn't. But my telescope, which is often propped up in the background, I'm going to show you this because obviously visual prompts work really well on podcasts. Look, it has actually made its way out of the corner in the other side of the room, and is now actually surveying the night sky.
Is that telescope powerful enough so you can actually watch what's going on at Silverstone from that range?
Well, I thought it would be, but when I tried to do that earlier, I'd been misinformed, so nobody had told me that telescopes don't work very well during the day, and also apparently Silverstone's not up from Stockholm.
Can I take issue with that? Telescopes work just as well during the day as they do during the night.
You just see less.
No, you see more during the day.
Well,
he's looking at the telescope puzzledly. What? Are you talking about the night sky you see less of?
Yes, obviously, because that's what telescopes are for.
They're making faraway objects look like they're closer. That's what they're for. Whether they're stars or whether they're
racing circuits. They're not binoculars, Ed.
They're definitely not binoculars. Definitely, that's very true. Maybe if you've got two telescopes, you could simulate that. Anyway, we've digressed. Let's get on with the matter at hand. Now, Mark, we're going to go straight to the business end of the race. Lap 50 of 52. Lewis Hamilton leads from Valtteri Bottas and Max Verstappen. All very easy. Then Bottas' front left goes.
Yeah, and he said there was no warning. I mean, he said he'd had vibration. We heard him over the radio saying, I've got a vibration here. It's not too bad. But he'd backed off to save it once he started getting the vibration. He stopped putting the pressure on Lewis. And everything was going quite routine. And then on the way down to Village, turn three, it just went. He wasn't expecting that. No one was. And then, of course, we saw two more, and there was the possibility of a fourth at Red Bull because Max was feeling there was something very wrong with his. So, yeah, it was very unexpected, and there's lots of investigation going on, as you can imagine, at Pirelli at the moment, trying to find out the exact cause. And we've got a few clues, and we've got a sort of working thesis, which I've just been writing about it for the report, which will be up online, in the early hours. So, it's a very, very demanding circuit on tyres, especially on the left front. It's the high-speed corners. It takes more energy out of the tyres than any other track on the calendar. That's one thing. But that really, all that does is, all that should do, all it was expected to do was impose quite a high wear rate on the tyres. It still wasn't expected that you wouldn't be able to do, I don't think they would end up doing 40 laps after Kvyat triggered the safety car and everybody came in. They were expected to be able to do a lot more than that. All the teams had been advised that would be able to do run into the mid to high 40s if need be, or even if necessary, if you were going to manage it, they could done pretty much the whole race distance. So, yeah, it was, they didn't realize they were running on the edge, but they were.
And of course, the key question is, we had the drama of Lewis Hamilton on the last lap, limping towards the line. I think he made it with something like 5.8, 5.9 seconds to spare ahead of Verstappen. But Verstappen, of course, had come in for a pit stop. Now, okay, this was there was talk about Red Bull being cautious, etc., concern about cuts. But fundamentally, it was for a fastest lap run, wasn't it? So
yeah,
they'll potentially be ruining that.
The idea was already there that they were going for the fastest lap, and the Bottas blowout didn't make them change their mind, because they still had that second. They now had a second place, a safe second place. It was going to be a safe third place, and they were still going to go for the point for the extra lap. As Max said afterwards, maybe my tyre might have gone on the last lap, and then I wouldn't have had anything. And as it is, I got a second place when I thought I was going to get a third. So you could look at it that way. It's easy to do in hindsight, to sort of look and say, oh, if only you'd stayed out, and it probably wouldn't have blown. But who's to say?
What do you think, Scott? Do you think that it's a question of they should have kept him out just on the off chance, especially once they saw Bottas go?
No, because you get into the realms of second guessing or trying to predict what's going to happen. And good Grand Prix teams, the best Grand Prix teams, as Mercedes have shown countless times, you play what's in front of you. And there was no guarantee whatsoever that they were going to benefit from Hamilton having exactly the same problem. Hamilton hadn't been running in dirty air for the entire Grand Prix. So you could easily have just chalked Bottas's down to misfortune or one-off, whatever, down to circumstance. And the other aspect as well is you've got to look at it as a second place gained rather than a win lost, because he was in third place. So I think they've still had a net gain from it, because it's an extra 4 points, isn't it, compared to what he would have had in a normal situation. I feel like it's one of those scenarios where you can't get too greedy. They've turned a third place and points lost to Mercedes, points lost to both Mercedes drivers in the Drivers' Championship, into a second place, nearly won, and Max has earned a bucket load of points versus Bottas in the fight for second.
Not sure I entirely agree with that. If I look at Red Bull's situation, I've criticised the fastest lap point before, often on the fact it's quite a cheap point, but also because I do believe that it's a good idea to keep yourself within trouble range of a car ahead. Cars do hit trouble on the last lap of Grand Prix. It does happen. Most of the time, it doesn't. But if you always kind of keep your car there, particularly when you're not massively chasing the championship, is Max Verstappen going to be a championship contender this year? Is that 1 point really going to make a difference? What is it? It would have been a 14-point swing had he managed to get past Hamilton. So I don't think this is this race specific, but in general terms, I tend to go with the principle of, you know, put yourself in the position to pick up the piece if something does go wrong, especially when the other car has hit trouble, unless they had a specific, explicit concern about the tyre. And I think everything they've said indicated it was just a general concern. Oh, well, lots of people had vibrations, etc. If it was that clear, I think they could have come in. But we can argue the toss on that all day. But I think Red Bull are in the business of just trying to get wins at this stage, realistically. So I in general, agree with the principle of you keep yourself out there. You put the maximum pressure on just on the off chance. You do that 50 times, you might win once. You never know. Few fastest laps don't really counterbalance that, I don't think.
No, but I think if they'd stayed out and Max's front left had gone, there's every chance we'd be sat here thinking, well, why did they stay out? They could see that other teams had problems. Maybe they'd have just been better off banking the result. I think it's always easy to look in hindsight at things they could have done differently or should have done differently. But I think normally I would feel like they're that it was a missed opportunity, I think. But I just, the bizarre circumstances of the race, the fact that they still gained a position, I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt, basically, that they can look at it like glass half full rather than half empty.
I think they'll try to do that, but they'll probably be frustrated by that. I think it depends on your situation. A bit like Raikkonen had the failure on the last lap at the Nürburgring in McLaren many years ago on the last, it was the first corner on the last lap. They were right to gamble for that. There was no point in them pitting him because of the championship situation. I think the same applies to Verstappen. But anyway, Let's move on to the Mercedes situation, Scott. We knew they were going to be dominant, but the margin of the advantage was enormous, wasn't it? Qualifying Max Verstappen was 1.033 off pole. In the race, the Mercedes drivers did have plenty of pace in hand. It was effortless until the tyre trouble hit. So what do you make of that? Are you surprised?
I am surprised, but I will flip your question slightly because I'm not necessarily surprised at the size of the Mercedes advantage. It's more the disadvantage that the others, the deficit that they've got, because I do think that as much as Mercedes is doing a mega job and they've clearly moved the power unit to a new level, which is fantastic, and they just do this amazing job year in, year out of maximising everything. They've done some cool stuff with the rear suspension this year. They've done an excellent job. But in their own words, they don't feel like they've made an extra special step in performance this year. And if you look at the year-on-year performance of Ferrari, which obviously over the course of the season has gone backwards in quite a dramatic way, Red Bull, I don't think, had made a step year-on-year for Silverstone qualifying. So I'm not trying to take anything away from Mercedes because I think they're doing a brilliant job. And I think even if Ferrari and Red Bull had done a good job, I think Mercedes would still be the team to beat. But I think the size of the gap is as much because Red Bull and Ferrari are dropping the ball as it is Mercedes are doing an excellent job. I'm still surprised, absolutely. It's an enormous margin. They looked absolutely brilliant, peerless this weekend. Lewis Hamilton can literally win a race with three wheels on his wagon. So they're doing a phenomenal job. I'm now at that point where I feel like my frustration at Red Bull and Ferrari is now getting to the point where it might be exceeding my admiration and respect for Mercedes.
Yeah, I largely agree with that. It's Red Bull and Ferrari have dropped out of the gap that used to be there and just left a great big gaping hole where the Merck's competition used to be. And their gap over the, I hate to use the term, but the Class B, the midfield, Merck's advantage over that is about the same as what it was last year. So they've made normal year-on-year gains. Ferrari and Red Bull have dropped back. There were three different ways Merck could have won this race. There were the way they did it with the three wheels on the last lap, or they could have done it with a pit stop with one lap to go after Bottas's tyre had gone. Or they could have done it by pulling out a pit stop worth of margin after the safety car, after the Kvyat triggered safety car. They easily had the pace to pull out the 18, 19 seconds you need for a pit stop here and to have just done a two-stop. So that's the size of their advantage. They've got very different ways to victories. You know, when you look back on it, there's lots of different ways they could have won it. I don't see anything really standing in their way other than ill luck. It's this season. There's very, very difficult to see anything beyond a Mercedes victory in any of the remaining, well, we don't know how many there are remaining, maybe 11, maybe 12 races. It's quite feasible they're going to clean sweep them all.
Well, as you say, that sort of speed gives you many different ways to win races because that just allows you to control things. But you could say, in terms of this question of can they win every race, we talked previously about the fact, well, something always goes wrong. I think they've dodged a bullet today. This was one they could easily have not won. They have won it. You know, if you're crossing the line with three wheels on your wagon, as Scott put it, then by definition, it's a close run thing. So this might actually be the sort of Monza 88 moment where, I don't know, Senna, the right rear wheel just hangs together and he limps to the line and somehow holds off the Ferrari after the collision. It might just be the sliding doors moment that changes things.
Well, Martin Brundle didn't have a clashing sports car race and he was driving a Williams rather than Schlesser and didn't get in the way.
Yeah, exactly. Then again, Senna colliding with Brundle, that did happen at Monza as well in 93, didn't it? But that was Senna's fault.
Yeah, it happened at Alton Park and Snetterden and most of the F3 tracks in 1983 as well.
Yeah. Well, let's have a look at one of the Mercedes drivers in particular. You know, Lewis Hamilton's performance speaks for itself. He's brilliant, isn't he? You know, he's an all-time great. What number win was that? 87, 80?
It doesn't matter what specific number it is. It is ridiculous. Just a crazy, crazy high number.
Yeah, but we're not going to talk too much about Lewis Hamilton on this one, despite another British Grand Prix victory. But Valtteri Bottas, Mark, I mean, it's kind of Groundhog Day for him, isn't it? He looked like he was on top until Q3, then Lewis Hamilton nailed it. And then on the second run, Bottas dug deep, matched Hamilton's first run time, only to discover Hamilton has just disappeared another 0.3 up the road, as it were. Then he has the puncher, and that's it, 30 points down. I mean, has that torpedoed his title hopes? And more importantly, just how hard is it to be Valtteri Bottas when it's just like, you dig deep and you think, oh, I've pulled something out of the bag there, only to discover that the guy on the other side of the garage has got a bigger bag that's just got more in it.
Yeah, yeah. I recall Eddie Irvine saying after a few years of Michael Schumacher's, being Michael Schumacher's teammate, it was, you can put up with it for a while, you know, like getting hit over the head with a cricket bat every 2 weeks, but eventually it wears you down. To his credit, Valtteri's not showing any signs of being worn down. He still comes back 2 weeks later or a week later and up for the battle again and takes it to him. But yeah, Lewis just always has a bit more in him, doesn't he? It's just more and more as he's gotten more experienced and is not losing his way so much like he usually occasionally used to do on setup. He's more attuned to the direction to follow, and then just pulls it all together and seems to know that he can, that it doesn't matter. Even he did that spin in Q2 or through
Q2.
You just know that that doesn't really matter. He's going to put it all together, and he's going to put all the bits together when it matters at the final run of Q3. And he just does. And it's like he's building up to that crescendo moment from the moment the wheels are turning on Friday morning. And he just has the game sauce.
I feel like it almost hasn't made that much difference to Bottas' title hopes, perversely. Yeah, it's 25 points gained Hamilton on him, but he's just got to keep doing the same thing, hasn't he? Because it doesn't change the equation for Bottas. He's got to do the most he can possibly do, and a bit like Rosberg in 16, hope that Hamilton has a bit more bad luck than him, and that gets him over the line. But it's tough being up against an all-time great driver like Hamilton. And you know, we all know that Bottas is a very, very, very good Grand Prix driver, but you're up against an all-time great, and we often see people struggling. I think he's doing pretty well, but we did see the key differences. Didn't quite have the same tyre management, so starting just to drop away a little bit. And then in qualifying, obviously the real key to Hamilton's pole lap was the fact that he just kept the tyres absolutely perfect in that first sector through the twiddly bits, leading onto the National Straight, as it used to be called, the Wellington Straight, it is now. Kept the car in line, didn't lock up, didn't slide, and that just meant he had the grip for the rest of the lap. So when it matters, Hamilton's just inch perfect.
Yeah, he just has a lovely feel for the car. So he will typically just, the car won't slide quite as much in the slow speed corners because he's ahead of it. Just, you know, we're talking tiny, tiny fractions of a second. And that means that the rear tires usually are not too hot, so that by the time you get to the long duration fast corners and your maggots and your cops and your maggots and beckets, the car's just got more grip just because you've handled it better earlier in the lap. And it's just those little things. They're not a demonstration of him driving faster, although he's capable of doing that as well. They're just a demonstration of a superior feel, an edge that he has over just about everyone. It plays out like that in this formula, but it doesn't really matter what the demands were or would be. He would find the way, and that's just what all the greats do.
I was disappointed by what Bottas did at the start, though. You know, Lewis didn't get a great getaway. But Bottas just seemed to, I don't know, I don't know whether he thought Max was going to hit his left rear quarter. I don't know if he thought that he was going to drift into Lewis or Lewis would drift into him, but he just seemed to give up halfway through the sweeps of turns one and two. And then all of a sudden Lewis was clear. Verstappen, it was such a big check up from Bottas that Verstappen had to get out of it and then try and fend off Charles Leclerc for third. I don't get it. Like, that's, you've been bested in qualifying, which is a straight fight, and Hamilton's done it. You know that this is a circuit that, because you're flat out so much of the time through loads of high-speed turns, you're not really going to get close to him during a stint. So surely the most sensitive and opportune moment to beat him is going to be off the line or on the opening lap. And we saw last year at the British Grand Prix that Bottas can go wheel to wheel with Hamilton in the right context, and he just didn't. I don't know why. I don't know if I'm judging it harshly, but it just felt like he just didn't want to go wheel to wheel with him.
Yeah, it did look that first few seconds of the race. You thought, oh, Bottas will be in the lead here, but you know it didn't quite come off. But it's just the usual thing, isn't it? Just comes up that tiny little bit short. Scott, let's have a look at the man in third place, Charles Leclerc. He was he qualified strongly, fourth place, third place in a trimmed out Ferrari at a track that does play to the car's weaknesses, but they decided they try and compensate for the power disadvantage on Saturday by leaning it out a bit. So people want to declare this a turnaround, won't they? But it's premature to say that. But it was a very, very good performance from Leclerc in a Ferrari team that had worked out the best way to mitigate its weakness.
Yeah, I think it was his best Grand Prix weekend performance probably since Monza last year. It was really, really good. Qualifying, absolutely brilliant. You could see that the car was not inspiring a lot of confidence because the low drag version that they'd worked on, the low downforce aero package for here, it was causing Vettel all sorts of problems in the limited amount of practice time that he had, but then mainly through qualifying. The difference in assertiveness that Leclerc had behind the wheel was fantastic. And then in the race, just I was waiting for the moment where it turned for him, where you know he gave himself every chance by qualifying in Q2 on the mediums and not having to run the softs, which were terrible for Ferrari on Friday. But it's still waiting for, like, right, okay, when's it going to go? It's not going. And it was only when Ricciardo got past the two McLarens right at the very end of the race that Leclerc suddenly came under any kind of threat, because Ricciardo just had brilliant pace at the end of the Grand Prix. And the gap, I think, got trimmed for like a second and a half or something. But that was the only moment where Leclerc looked any kind of vulnerable in terms of pace. It was just brilliantly executed. And it sounds crazy, doesn't it? To imagine if we'd said at the end of last year or even in pre-season that a Ferrari driver would be doing an absolutely sterling job to qualify fourth and hold off a Renault for a podium. But I think Leclerc was absolutely majestic this weekend. I really think he was brilliant.
Yeah, I think he's probably my driver of the weekend. I'll go over a bit more data before deciding finally, but really, really outstanding. And obviously the thing that gives us that reference point is Sebastian Vettel, Mark. Now, he really struggled with the car leaned out. He finished 10th, and bear in mind, in a normal race where no one else hits trouble, Leclerc would have been fourth anyway, probably. And you had Vettel would have been sort of 12th, 13th. You know, that's a huge difference.
He had a horrible weekend, really. Silverstone, he's never really liked. It's full, it's sort of fast sweeping corners that it's not his forte. It's the slow, quick direction change stuff that he's always excelled at. He used to struggle here against Kimi Raikkonen, even in the Ferrari. So it's not his favourite place. But on top of that, you had a Ferrari which was very, very low on downforce, deliberate choice that they've made because of their power situation. So that just made the bits that Seb's uncomfortable with even worse. And on top of that, he has a horrible reliability on the Friday, and got virtually no running in at all on the Friday. So yeah, pull all those things together, and he wasn't very happy. And he was saying after the race that his confidence in the car was very, very low. He didn't feel that he could get in tune with it at all. He's not in a good place this weekend at all. But you know, it'll turn around when we go to other circuits that have got different characteristics, like shorter, slower corners. I'm sure we'll see him right back relative to Leclerc, not relative to the rest of the field. But yeah, and I think Ferrari did a good job with what they had this weekend, generally. That you know, the very, very low downforce thing that they had, the trim that they had, which is purely because of how little horsepower they've got. But it maybe helped them in the end with the loads on the tires too. They're just, you know, they're not putting the same loads on that left front as the fast cars, so the high downforce cars. So they were probably further away from the tire problems than anyone else as well.
Yeah, and I think it's obviously it looks very bad for Vettel, and it was a very poor weekend for him, but it shows just how condensed that whole pack was. At one stage, pretty much everyone was in a big DRS train, weren't they? So kind of third place to Leclerc, back down to kind of Vettel in the end. I suppose Russell was the next one, and on merit, who was just kind of off the back of that group. So really small differences add up to a hell of a lot there. And I think it speaks very well for how good Leclerc was to qualify fourth and finish third in a car that was very tricky. I mean, I asked him after the race how concerned he was about the tyres in the race. And he said, yeah, they were worried that the tyres would go away. It wasn't too bad. He had a few situational advantages. Grosjean was a bit of a blockade for him. Gave him a little bit of time early on, kind of paying back the favour Leclerc did Haas and Magnussen last time out, actually. But yeah, I mean, Leclerc has had a really strong season this year. And actually, Vettel's been largely good. He wasn't good here, but you know, Leclerc continuing to enhance his reputation apart from the mishap in the Styrian Grand Prix. Now, Mark, Racing Point was extremely conspicuous from this battle for the last podium place. It should have been in there. We expect it to be. So where did this pace go to? We can talk about the other drivers shortly, but obviously Lance Stroll, really disappointing run. He ended up in ninth place, didn't really go anywhere in the race.
Yeah, I'm not really drilled down in the exact circumstances of his race, but he faded, didn't he? And he was in among the McLarens and, ahead of the Renaults for a while, and then just faded and got passed not just by both Renaults, but also the Pierre Gasly and the recovering Alex Albon. So, yeah, I mean, it coming to a circuit that the car should have excelled at, We lost the reference point as well of Nico Hülkenberg because he didn't even start the race. So just the time when everything was on Lance's shoulders and he's sort of got a nice sort of momentum going coming up to this race where you thought, well, this could really be, a career-defining moment for you. You're in a car which should be absolutely super around here. Everybody's relying on you. You're the only car, out there. And it just didn't happen. And now, I don't know, as I say, I haven't yet drilled down specifically into his race. He may have had some specific problems that I haven't had a chance to look at yet. But, it didn't look great from the outside.
He was certainly complaining over the radio about the engine not pulling when he wanted to, although he was getting comments about the battery and that state of charge and everything. So, Scott, you heard from Otmar Szafnauer after the race, didn't you?
Yeah, it was a bit of... Otmar was fairly honest. There was a little bit of making excuses, but generally owning up to the fact that they were off the pace. They just didn't have the pace they thought they'd have on the long runs. A couple of the mitigating circumstances that Otmar was looking for. One was obviously they qualified. They got through Q2 on the medium with Stroll, and the idea was then you'd run long in the first stint. So they're blaming being on the mediums instead of the softs for Stroll giving up some track position at the start. I think he dropped from 6th to 8th on the opening lap. He got passed by, who would it have been, Sainz and Ricciardo. And then the safety car obviously nullified any potential advantage for the strategy because everyone came in and switched to the hards. So he lost track position early on. And any chance he'd have had of his probably superior strategy in a normal Grand Prix paying dividends later on didn't pan out. So then obviously got going again in a bit of in that DRS train and just didn't have the pace or the performance. And I think the car was obviously more difficult than they thought it was going to be. But I might be being cynical and unfair, but I also just think that Stroll gets into these ruts in races where it starts to go away from him. And I feel like he just checks out, to be honest. You know, he was complaining at one point. I think it felt like his engineer snapped at him because he was like, I don't have anything else. And he's got, well, you've got energy, so use it. And it was almost like a, come on, like actually pay attention to what you've got at your disposal. And we saw it in Hungary, didn't we, when he got frustrated. He was stuck behind a Haas. And he was getting frustrated saying he just couldn't get past him. It was a Haas. There's no excuse for not getting past it quicker. I just feel like if it had been Perez or even Hülkenberg in that situation, I've had a little bit more confidence at them maybe forcing the issue a bit more.
Yeah, I think unless there's a specific problem that subsequently comes to light. You can say that's been a fairly disappointing performance overall from Stroll in a car that is good. We've seen that that car does have race pace. Look at the Styrian Grand Prix. But of course, the car that had the race pace and the incisiveness there was Perez, wasn't it? And Stroll does have this habit of getting stuck. I think when he needs to, he can attack well on the first lap, but not always the best overtaker, shall we say. So big asterisk against Racing Point generally for me in terms of execution, everything this season. They've got a really quick car, done a great job, but four races in, they're just not getting the results. And okay, we've got to talk about the other side of the garage. They had some misfortune there. Now, Scott, you spent all of practice and then the first two parts of qualifying riding with comeback kid Nico Hülkenberg. That was effectively it for his weekend, given an engine problem prevented him from starting the race. And obviously he didn't make Q3. He filled in, of course, for Sergio Perez. So what did you make of his weekend, or should we say his day and a half?
Yeah, I basically wasted my Friday and Saturday, didn't I? Considering he didn't even take part in the Grand Prix. I was really impressed with him, especially on Friday. He jumped in and I think like literally his first timed lap, I was watching it and I was smiling while watching it because I was just like, he's pretty much cracking on. This is incredible. You could tell that he was keen to get on with it. He did a really good job. There was an amazing bit about three quarters of an hour into FP1 where I was fortunate enough to listen to probably 3 minutes, maybe 4 minutes of a mini debrief with his engineer while he was in the car. Hulk just started talking. He was asked about something else and then he went, yeah, okay, so now onto the car, and just reeled off this amazing list of things that he was happy with from the first runs, things that he were different to last year, things that he needed to get more comfortable with. They had a 30-second conversation about the steering responsiveness and the geometry. They talked about power assisted steering settings. Maybe that could change after FP1. And I was like, this is amazing. Like 40 minutes, 45 minutes, maybe 50 minutes in, and he's already trying to dial into areas of big performance gains. And he took that into FP2. His race pacing, his long runs in FP2 were really encouraging. And then on Saturday, he made a really good step on his one lap pace. So the low fuel running was really good. Q1, he was mega. And then Q2, I just felt like he got disrupted by trying to do what Stroll did and qualify, get through on the mediums. And he didn't. He wasn't going to make it. So they then had to switch to the softs anyway. And he didn't have the lap time in him. It was a bit of a scruffy lap. So I almost felt like he'd have been better off having that first lap on softs just to keep building the momentum, because that ultimate performance is where he's going to be lacking. But in the end, whether he'd qualified eighth on and had to start on softs or 13th as he did and have free choice, didn't matter anyway, because they think that a bolt somewhere in, I think it was, the suggestion was the gearbox, but Otmar wasn't entirely convinced. Basically, a bolt somewhere sheared and got stuck in a position that basically caused the engine to seize. It wouldn't turn over, so they couldn't even fire the engine up. So yeah, his race was, he didn't even make it out for a reconnaissance lap, just stuck in the garage.
There's a certain irony there, because we're all discussing, could he end this record of 177 races without a podium? That's more than anyone else without a podium. But he neither ended that record, nor did he add to his starts, which was actually probably the least likely outcome of all.
Yeah, you didn't think of that one, did
you?
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, we should have put some money on the outsider one. But Mark, how about Sergio Perez? He failed the COVID test. You know, we've both been tested for COVID-19 regularly. We've passed with flying colours, thankfully. There have only been three negative tests out of almost 20,000. It might even be past 20,000 now, which is hugely impressive. But Perez failed the test. Initially, it was inconclusive. They did a retest. He was out. Obviously, there's been some criticism of him among people. What do you make of it? Do you think it was just bad luck? Was it misadventure?
You can run to meet your bad luck, can't you? And going to a COVID hotspot, whilst having sympathy for the reason why he went out there, his mum had an accident, he wanted to go and see her, and she was in hospital, and he wanted to go and see her as she was coming out. We've all got sympathy for that, but you shouldn't be surprised if you come back with the virus, if you go to a virus hotspot. It shows, so we were talking about this morning, weren't we? It shows that the system that F1's got in place is worked. In that you come here and you have to be tested to get back in to the bubble, to the F1 bubble. And he didn't. So he was free to do as he pleased between the races, and he did. And then you have to get tested to see if he can get back in, and he couldn't. So really, I'm no one to blame. It's just one of those things.
Yeah, exactly. I think people misunderstand a little bit what the protocols and the code of conducts are there to do. It's to cover the safety of the events. Everyone in Formula One can't be controlled for 6 months solid outside and between and everything. So it's once you're into the event is where it's covered. Your behaviour is limited. In between, you can do what you want. It's interesting, actually. Jean Todt did say this morning, I was part of an audience of about half a dozen of us, journalists, had a little audience with the FIA president, and he said that he thought probably what happened to Perez would be a little bit of a warning, not in terms of doing anything wrong, because he says, well, you know, anything you if you do something, there's a risk attached. You take the risk. Bang. But he suspected that might just remove any suspicion among the drivers that they're impregnable, because obviously Perez said, well, I took a private plane. Well, that doesn't protect you, does it? Just because you're not flying commercial. So it just shows that this virus is out there. We can all, any of us who are here, we take precautions, but, you know, there's not zero risk. Every time we do anything, there's a risk attached to it.
Of course. And, just a private plane is okay. It cuts out one of the places where you might get it. But if you land your private plane in the middle of a COVID hotspot, you might get COVID.
Yeah, I think Todd's right, actually, that it will lead people just to be that little bit more careful, because it's a question of your career, isn't it? You know, Perez is trying to just remind everyone that if they do get Vettel, that he's very good. He hasn't had a brilliant start to the season. It's been a bit up and down. So the last thing he needs to do is miss races. He's missed this one. He's probably going to miss the second Silverstone. It's possible he could miss Spain, because hopefully he'll clear up soon, but we don't know.
Well, all I'd add to that is that this weekend Sunday's race has actually been a good advertisement of why Racing Point need Perez, because, as you point out, Perez did not take part in the Grand Prix. He contracted COVID-19. Nico Hülkenberg didn't even make the start, and Lance Stroll still only scored two more points than the pair of them in a car that probably should have been fighting for a podium. So this wasn't really a good advert for Stroll's credentials as a team leader.
Yeah, especially seeing as Stroll picked up two places to Sainz and Bottas' problems as well. So he could easily have been 11th in that race. So, yeah, I mean, get well soon, Sergio Perez. He's said he's asymptomatic, etc. So hopefully he'll have no lasting effects. Hopefully he'll test positive fairly soon and we'll see him back.
Negative.
Test negative, sorry.
It is confusing, isn't it?
I wished him some tremendous ill will there. I was testing positive bad. Oh, I might have to go and speak to someone about it. No, my results have been
So you're what you're so you want Checo to keep having coronavirus, Ed?
Apparently so. I was being a spokesman for Nico Hülkenberg there. Probably no, I'm sure Nico wouldn't wish that. But yes, best wishes, Checo Perez. I'm sure you're listening. He's always listening to what we have to say. Then again, he hasn't got too much to do at the moment while he's isolating. So, but yeah, hopefully we'll see him back in the car, fit and healthy, very, very soon. Mark, let's have a look at McLaren and Renault. Now, McLaren was strong all weekend, spent the vast majority of the race ahead of the Renaults. Looked like they get a hat full of points. Come the end of the race, we had Ricciardo fourth, Ocon sixth, Norris between them, Sainz obviously dropped down to 13th. McLaren ended up sort of with a small hatful of points rather than a half a hatful. So what do you make of that performance? Obviously, a lot of it was situational, mm-hmm. but Ricciardo was quick at the end. He was disappointed he didn't catch Leclerc.
Yeah. The McLaren's got more downforce than the Renault, and so you can see that in the corners that it's quicker than, and also how it tends to be a little bit slower down the straights. So it found the tyre problem earlier, and you heard it. There was one stage in the race where you heard Lando's engineer say, can you ease up, can you get a bit closer to Carlos in front of you, just because we want to fend off Ricciardo when he gets past the Haas. And he said, not really, I'm looking after my left front. He said, you need to get Carlos to get a move on so we can both move up together. Because Lando clearly felt if he got in the dirty air, he was going to trash his tyre. And this was still This is only mid-30s laps, so they're still a long way from the end. So he's already aware of the problem. So they asked Carlos to, could he, you know, hurry? And he said, no, I've got a vibration on my left front. I don't want to push it anymore. So I think it's significant that the cars with the high downforce were finding the tire problem. The Renault has less downforce, so a bit like the Ferrari, probably wasn't finding that problem on the tire quite so early. But also, Ricciardo again did a fantastic race, and it's very easy for him to fall under the radar in the car in that part of the grid.
I think he's had a really good season.
He's had a fantastic season, and I think there are three outstanding drivers this weekend. Lewis Hamilton was one of them. Charles Leclerc was the other one, and I think Daniel Ricciardo was the third. He did just his pace. He does that thing where he maintains position without taken a lot from the tires, and then he just turns it on at the end. He's done it so many times, not coincidence, and he just has this fantastic pace at the end because he's just not taken the life out of the tires and everybody else around him has, but he's kept his position in the field ready to unleash it at the end. He did it again, and his pass didn't show it on TV, but his pass on the last lap of Lando in the Stowe sounds like it was a good one.
Yeah, you saw that, didn't you, Scott? Well, I think both myself and Mark have heard Daniel talk about it, but you've actually watched that.
Yeah, it was really good. I actually think Ricciardo's undersold it, which is not like him because he's normally quite the advocate of his daring overtakes. I think he's taken a bit of credit away from himself because it looks like Lando's McLaren's clipping when just as they get to the end of the hangar straight. He catches him quite late. Obviously in the tow, DRS, maybe Lando having a little bit of an issue, just right at the end of the straight, but it's a proper like old school dart out at the end of into Stowe under brakes. And I think we saw quite a lot through the weekend in the support categories of people doing the opposite and overtaking around the outside because Stowe's now so, obviously it's always been high speed on entry, but you can carry so much speed through it now that it is actually perfectly feasible to go around, just drive around the outside of someone there. It's not really like it's not a big stop, is it? Even though you have monstrously high speeds down that straight. So for Ricciardo to just properly send it down the inside was really, really good. Although, as I was telling you, Ed, a little bit before we recorded the podcast, I did get quite amusingly furious when I was trying to find that overtake to the point where I thought Ricciardo had made it up because I was desperately trying to find, I was trying to find it on F1 TV on the onboards, and I got on board with Ricciardo, two laps to go. He's tucked right up underneath or fairly close to a McLaren coming out of Copse, and then they go through Maggots, Beckett's, and the McLaren exits stage left. Ricciardo carries on through Beckett's, the McLaren rejoins, then they go down the hangar straight, and it looks like because the McLaren's come really slow off a Chapel, Ricciardo pulls alongside and gets past him. So I'm watching this and then I look back at the quotes and I'm thinking, well, this is just nonsense. Is Ricciardo having us on here? Because he said, didn't he, that he'd asked his trainer if it got shown on the broadcast. The trainer said no. The question was, oh, we didn't see it because it wasn't on TV. And I thought, oh, Daniel's sort of spotted an opportunity here to properly talk something up when it's actually nothing. And then after about 10 minutes of interrogation, I realised I was watching his overtake on Sainz. It's the wrong McLaren.
That's the quality of analysis we expect from you. I would like just to throw in a positive for Ocon. He was the lesser Renault driver this weekend. He was 2 tenths slower in qualifying. But he did have a pretty good race. He was a bit unfortunate. I don't know entirely why, but he lost a place to Vettel under those in that round of safety car pit stops. They all had, I presume, he had to hold because there was traffic, and then he had to kind of come back through Vettel. So a good solid performance from Ocon, not at Ricciardo's level, but as we've said, Ricciardo he has been. He was one of the stars of the weekend. He's been one of the strongest drivers this season, certainly. Now, Scott, let's move on to some Red Bull stable mates in 7th and 8th. They were the wrong way round, of course, with Pierre Gasly 7th and Alex Albon 8th. But before we get into Albon, it's going very well for Gasly this year, isn't it? He's just bossing Kvyat in qualifying, and by and large, he has a decent fist of getting points if the car holds together.
Yeah, I would have guessed before the start of the season that there was nothing that Gasly could really do to make himself seem like a viable option to Red Bull again. I kind of felt like he's been put back in the junior team because there's nowhere else really to put him, but there's nowhere no one to replace him. He'd need a really exceptional season to get properly back on the senior team's radar. Well, actually, I think Gasly's probably doing about everything that's realistic to do exactly that. As you say, he's smashed Kvyat so far. He's doing a great job in qualifying. He's racing really well. He did a brilliant job today. I really liked his move on Vettel, and he basically made pretty no fuss of the Ferrari. So, yeah, another excellent race for Pierre Gasly.
So when it comes to Albon, Mark, Albon had the crash in FP2. Fell in Q2 again. Obviously, lots of people talking about the pressure on him. And obviously, Gasly finishing ahead will lead to more saying that. And then he had the clash in the race. But before we get on to the clash itself, how do you see Albon's overall performance? I think maybe this weekend wasn't quite as bad as some were making out.
Before his crash, he was going very quickly. And although Max didn't get a clear run, in the equivalent session, because he'd been held up by Grosjean, it did look as though they were very, very close on raw pace. Alex was a little bit on the edge probably, and a little gust of wind as he turned into Stowe was all it took in a car that's notoriously edgy and tricky and takes just the slightest little inconsistency of you know, how you move the steering or how the wind happens to catch it, and it's gone. And we've seen this so many times this year, and it happened not the worst possible moment, but a bad moment. It sort of interrupted the momentum of his weekend quite badly, and they had to rebuild the car, and then there were electrical problems with the rebuilt car, and he didn't get much running. And then, of course, he didn't make Q3, which looks bad when you're in a Red Bull, but actually he was only a couple of tenths off Max. It's probably the closest he's been this year to him in that. And I think probably with the lack of running that he had, trying to go through on the medium was probably a little bit ambitious. And if they'd just done what Renault and McLaren had done and just said, let's get the maximum out of the softs, we can get two runs in Q2 and just make three, he would have got through comfortably. But it was an ambitious choice, I think. Hülkenberg made the same choice at Racing Point and fell in the same way. So, yeah, I think probably not as bad as it looks. And then, of course, he has the first lap accident, which I don't really think was his fault. I think it was a legitimate gap to go for. I think Kevin hadn't realised he was going to be there. Kevin caused the gap to be there. He clipped the curb a bit awkwardly and lost a bit of momentum, and that presented Alex with a gap. And, you know, when you're starting that far back in a Red Bull, you're not going to be waiting for, you know, big invite opportunities. You're just going to be taking them as any half chance you can find. You've got to get on with it. You've got to start making progress. And those two things came together. So he's gone through a bad run, but I think he may actually have turned a corner this weekend, because I think when you look a little bit deeper below the surface, I think his raw pace and the little flashes that we saw of it, we didn't get that much of a chance to see them, but the little flashes that we did suggest that actually he's making good progress.
And we should be able to find out a little bit about that in the appallingly named 70th anniversary Grand Prix weekend that we've got coming up, the repeat race at Silverstone. Now, Scott, what did you make of that? Now, Albon was a little bit frustrated because I think he felt his tyres weren't really up to temperature for the start, so he was trying to sort of make some progress at the end of the first lap. Magnussen had made a very fine start and got up to 12th place. I think you're going to agree with Mark on this one, because you were quite annoyed about that penalty, weren't you?
Well, yeah, because it was stupid. it was a racing incident. It was in exactly the same way as I felt the Hamilton Albon incident in Austria was a racing incident. You've got, I don't understand how the stewards can say they took into account the fact that Magnussen was slow off the previous corner, and they've still determined that Albon's predominantly to blame, because they basically say, well, we understand why this was a completely legitimate move and the door was closed on him, but he's still the person at fault, which I just think is stupid, because we're into this position now, and I've been saying this for a few weeks, where it feels like the stewards now, they see contact, they decide that there has to be a penalty, and therefore they will find a way to apportion a predominant amount of blame, instead of just saying that sometimes it's unfortunate and one party will come off a lot worse in what is fundamentally a racing incident. So yeah, I thought it was silly. I actually didn't think Albon did anything wrong. I wasn't that impressed by what he did afterwards. Christian Horner was saying that he thought Albon drove brilliantly today and did a really good job in his recovery. I kind of felt like Albon sort of did his usual thing of being really, really quick at times, especially once he was in clear air. But I didn't feel like it was his... I feel like he's driven better in traffic. You know, like it felt a bit similar to Spa, his Red Bull debut last year, where he was a bit stuck in the DRS train initially. Maybe he was nursing a bit of damage on the front left. But then he sort of impressed a bit more in the second stint once he had a little bit more rhythm.
Yeah, eighth place in the end for Albon. I think that's that whole thing about Hulley are predominantly to blame. I think it was a classic racing incident, because you could see why that you wouldn't normally make a move there, but the move happened because, as you said, Mark, he absolutely thumped the curve and kicked his car wide. So yeah, I thought that was a slightly strange one. But yeah, I think underlying some gains from Albon, his new race engineer, Simon Rennie. So we'll see that this weekend. Now, while we're talking about Haas and Stewart's decisions, Mark, Romain Grosjean, he spent the first stint of the race, well, the second half of his first stint, towards the sharp end, thanks to being the only driver not to stop. So he ran long on the mediums to gain some track position in the hope of just doing something strategically. Didn't pay off result-wise, but he got a warning for his behaviour and the way he defended against Sainz moving across on him into Stowe, and Ricciardo doing the same thing on the run to Brooklands. Do you think the GPDA chairman went too far?
Yes, I do. And when he was informed of the penalty, he said, "Well, I left him half the track." Well, that's true, he did, but that wasn't really the point. It was the fact that he shimmied very suddenly across that makes the following driver, in this case Sainz, not know whether that he's going to continue going that way. So you can't commit into that space, because it looks like the guy's going to be there by the time you get there. So you can't use the latent threat of violence to, you know, to dissuade a legitimate move. Is Sainz supposed to think, yeah, well, he's just bluffing there, he's moving violently, but he's going to leave me half the track? You can't assume that, especially at these speeds. So no, I don't think his etiquette was quite right there. Similar comments on his Ricciardo move. I don't think that was quite as outrageous, but it still wasn't very nice. So yeah, I think Grosjean's probably getting a little bit frustrated, a little bit bitter. You know, it's not really happened for him, and it doesn't reflect well for, as you say, someone who's in a leading position of the GPDA.
Yeah, well, he's asked for clarification on this, because he basically said, well, I don't really like it, but I thought Max Verstappen got away with it a few years ago and we didn't put an explicit rule in place, so I did it. I mean, the thing I don't like about it is, if it's misjudged, you can end up with a bit of a plane crash, can't you? Because you can end up getting a wheel-to-wheel launch. We have seen that in some other categories in particular in the past, and it can be really, really serious. So I'm not surprised he got a warning and for that thing, and they're going to talk about it in the driver's briefing. So I hope he doesn't do that again, because I just don't think it's really very very safe. We want hard racing, but that's not hard racing. It seems odd to me that outright dangerous, violent threats of violence, as you put it, are fine, or you'd get away without a penalty, whereas that Albon one, you don't. But there we go. That's the rules. In terms of the rest of the field, Daniel Kvyat had a bit of an eventful one. He ended up going off the rear snapped on him, going into in the, sort of the first part of Maggots, the left hander. He initially took responsibility, but then he said it wasn't. He'd just done a switch change, but also Franz Tost, the team principal, suggested that maybe there was a puncture as well. So it did look like something had gone wrong, because it just went so quickly.
Yeah, there's a working theory that the switch changes what distracted him and led him to clip the curb, and it's clipping the curb that may have punctured the tire, which then, you know, the accident unfolded as it did. I don't know, some combination, some unfortunate combination. But he's not having a great time of it. It's really not. So his season sort of collapsing under the pressure of Gasly's performances in the other car. So yeah, he needs to turn that around pretty sharpish. Really, he's. We talk about Albon being under pressure. I think actually Kvyat's under more pressure.
Yeah, he needs a season to turn around as quickly as the car turned around when it went on him. Now, in terms of the other finishers, obviously. Outside the top 10, Bottas down in 11th. George Russell in 12th place. A good run for Russell. He was delighted to actually be able to overtake a non-Williams on merit in normal circumstances. He was saying he thinks that's the first time he's really done that in a normal racing situation, not on the first lap or not passing a hobbled car. Williams have done some work to try and get the car quicker on race pace, because it's been a comfortable, an uncomfortable, really, you would say, when you're slowest 10th. Fastest of the 10 cars in the previous races, but it was actually going racing this time, and they held on to their Q2 pace. But of course, he had the 5 place grid penalty for not respecting the yellow flag, but 12th place for Russell is a good result. He picked up a place from Sainz, who is 13th. Not much to say about the Alfa Romeos. Giovinazzi in 14th, Raikkonen classified 17th, and I think was he running at the end after he had that off? I think he was still there somewhere, but obviously we didn't pay too much attention to him after he'd had that problem with a bit of front wing braking. And then, yeah, in between those two, there's Latifi 15th and Grosjean down in 16th. And of course, we had a few non-finishers. But yeah, I guess the place we should finish is, we are going to do all this again in a few days. Should we expect anything particularly different? The way I look at it is, we're not going to see a dramatically different shape. But I quite like that midfield, that group from sort of third down to 11th in the final finishes of that race. You can sort of pick them all up, shake them all, and have a completely different order.
Yeah, a bit kaleidoscope with some pink, some orange, and some yellow in there, and occasionally a bit of white. And will it be different? Yeah, I think it probably will. The competitive order at the front's pretty much set, but yeah, in that midfield, definitely. And I think the way the race will play out will be different, because we've got the softer compound. So it's probably going to be a two-stop. It's going to be hotter weather. So again, pushing it all towards two-stop. So it's probably going to be a more varied race than this one was. Because up until the time of the tyres started going pop, this was looking a very uneventful race, Kvyat's accident aside. I don't think next week's will be. I think there'll be a lot of jostling and a lot of strategic variation.
Yeah, of course, the tyres are going to be one step softer, which actually shouldn't be such a big problem, because we probably won't see these marathon stints on the tyres. So hopefully Pirelli will get on top of it. I suspect they'll probably, as you suggested, come back with the explanation that it was debris. Are you waiting to make a final declaration, Scott?
Well, I was just going to say that's all true, and I agree, as long as the solution isn't for them to say, actually, in light of the problems that we've had this weekend, we're going to go back to the same compounds, or we're going to raise the tyre pressures to a point where it's actually relatively the same. Because, as you say, the race was dull until the last 2.5 laps, into the last like 4 minutes and 42 seconds. It was a pretty boring race. So as long as the solution, as long as it's basically, yep, this is fine to crack on because we know what the problem is. What I'd hate is in like 24 or 48 hours time, we're told we're not entirely sure, and in the interest of safety, we're going to use these compounds, or we're going to mandate a higher tyre pressure, and then the teams will realise they can actually just basically do what they normally do and one stop it.
Well, at some point, we do expect Pirelli to give us their definitive verdict on what caused the problem. Obviously, they're going through all the tyres now, so Monday or at the latest Tuesday, I expect we'll have some news on that on the race website. So head there, therace.com. Don't forget the hyphen. There'll be Mark Hughes' in-depth race analysis, my driver rating. As usual, Scott Mitchell will have been writing about something or other. I never quite know at this stage what it's going to be. You never know what you're going to get with Scott Mitchell. There's some Gary Anderson on there, and of course our YouTube channel will be doing videos and all sorts on there, plus our other podcast, the Gary Anderson F1 Show, where Gary Anderson will tell you what he thinks is wrong this week. And do subscribe to this podcast as well if you haven't already done so. Thanks for listening, and we're going to do it all again in a few days' time.